Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
This episode is brought to you by Coffee Mate. Coffee Mate is the world's biggest coffee lover because we love all the ways you enjoy. What? Wait. Coffee Mate can't love coffee more than me. I'm a foodie. I went to Kyoto just for a nitro matcha latte. What? Oh, I have to finish the ad. Coffee Mate, for the love of coffee.
Your teen requested a ride, but this time not from you. It's through their Uber teen account. You drive your teenager around, a lot, to their friend Jacob's house, their other friend Jake's house, to James's, to Jaden's, to Jalen's, to...
Mom, this is Jake's house, not Jacob's.
Now with an Uber teen account, your teen can request a ride under your supervision. They'll ride with a highly rated driver, and with live trip tracking, you'll follow along the whole ride to their friends' houses that all sound the same. Add your teen to your Uber account today. See app for details.
Bye, Mom.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure and honor today of inviting to the podcast, of welcoming to the podcast, Dr. Tracy Pinchman, who is Professor of Religious Studies and Director of the Global Studies Program at Loyola University Chicago. She is a scholar of goddess traditions on this side of the ocean. We will be looking at a brand new publication called Goddess Beyond Boundaries, Worshipping the Eternal Mother at a North American Hindu Temple. Tracy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Raj.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I vividly recall encountering the rise of the goddess in the Hindu tradition at some point in my undergraduate dabbling, and then I ended up focusing on the Devi Mahatmya. So I became very familiar with your work. So it's delightful to be able to connect with you in this forum. So this Hindu temple in North America, mm-hmm. Which temple is this, and how did you get interested in it?
Sure. Well. So I actually write about that in the book. It's at the very beginning, how I stumbled upon the temple. And that actually, the way in which I came across the temple actually became an inspiration for some of the ways in which I structured the book. I was supposed to go back to India in about 2006, 2007, after completing my second monograph, which is actually on Hindu women's traditions, Hindu women's worship of Krishna. It was called Guess at God's Wedding, and is about Hindu women's traditions surrounding the marriage of Tulsi and Krishna. And I was going to go back to India to study women's traditions in Magh, because many of the women that I connected with when I was in Benares in the late 1990s said, oh, you must come back for Magh. There's so much we do. But between completing the research for the book on Kartik, Women's Devotions to Krishna During the Month of Kartik, and 2006, 2007, when I was next up for a leave of absence, I had two children. One of my children had asthma and some health problems, and I was very concerned about leaving them for some time. So I would do these searches online, just kind of looking at things that intersected with my interests. And one day I was on hold for, I don't know, a doctor's office, a student, something, and the Parashakti temple popped up. And I thought, this is interesting, because most of the board members were Euro-Americans. They were not Indian. I thought, this is different. And so I write about this in the book, how I went to visit the temple and how the temple construes, or at least the officials of the temple told me later that they understood that the goddess was calling me to the temple to do the work. And this idea of kind of shifting between my academic training, my academic Western framing of the traditions, and using some kind of Hindu framing and engaging both in the book became part of how I later started to really think about the book more deeply.
commingling the Edic and Emic paradigms, perhaps.
Yes, although I don't like Emic and Edic.
Tell us more about that.
So I think it was Rita Sharma who actually said this. We're all Edic as scholars, right?
Yes, that sounds like Rita Sharma. Yes,
we are. We're all looking at the tradition, not as believers or insiders, even if we are, and I'm not, but I don't consider myself to be Hindu. On the other hand, I'm not entirely Edic either, because I've been doing this for almost 40 years. So I do think in Hindu concepts, you know, and I do, you know, I invoke things like sthula and sukshma, gross and subtle, hot and cold, tapas, shakti, you know, all of these concepts have become very much part of my lived vocabulary. And that is, I think, for all of us who study Hindu traditions, that's probably true. So for that reason, Emic and Edic strike me as problematic in the extreme, in the way that they're usually used. Emic is usually used for somebody inside the tradition. Edic is for somebody just standing outside. We're never, as scholars, fully either one or the other. But what I do try to do is use a kind of decolonial framing, right? So to bring in the book, not only Western frames of analysis, but also Hindu frames of analysis. And that's why each chapter has two titles. And that's why the way I structured the book is the way I structured the book.
I love the elemental dimension to your outline. Yeah. And that, you know, the Edic Emic divide, while there's utility and clearly it's useful thinking about that, it very much is artificial in a sense, insofar as how can one not be invested after studying a topic so infectious and transformative of all things Indic for multiple decades? I mean, as you say, it sort of concepts seep into your way of being, your way of thinking. But, you know, tell us about the structure of the book and the dual citizenship of the titles.
Sure. The way I structure the book, I lay this out in the introduction, again, uses these two different kinds of frames of analysis. Actually, the book is sort of a palimpsest, theoretically speaking, in terms of the conceptualization of the book. But I use the five elements. So I start with Earth and I end with space. And so each of the chapters is named after an element, starting with Earth, water, fire, wind, and Akash, or space, at the end. And I use this very deliberately because the five elements, the Mahabhutas, are so fundamental to tantric and vernacular Hindu goddess traditions, thinking about the structure of the goddess. And I also, as I lay out in the beginning of the book, the intro, thought of the book as kind of a yantra, okay, kind of a mandala. So going from the outermost circle to the innermost circle. So I start with Earth, I start actually in India, with my field research in India, and the way in which the goddess brings the temple, according to temple discourse, and establishes the temple on American Earth. And then I move through the different layers to end with concepts of how people think about the goddess at the temple, especially her nature as Akash, as ether, as space, as being beyond all form, and so on. So that's the kind of attempt to engage some kind of Hindu framing. At the same time, I am a Western scholar. And so I use the theme of crossings, which I borrow from Thomas Tweed, in each of the chapters as well. And there's tons of Western theory in the book. So it doesn't only engage Hindu framing. I use tons of theory, Western academic theory, in the book. But I start with crossings of Earth, so the goddess crossing over from India to the United States. And then I look at the way in which the goddess crosses into people's lives, the founders of the temple. And so each of the chapters also addresses a crossing. That could be geographical crossings, so bodily crossings. I forgot what the other ones were. It's in the table of contents.
ritual crossings, divine crossings, as a
result. Thank you. Yes. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. The divine crossings are at the end. The way in which the goddess crosses into people's emotions, into their dreams, into their lives, in ways that intervene with their lives. So there are five different kinds of crossings. So each of the chapters engages one of the elements. One of the Mahabhutas, one of the elements, Earth, one of the five gross elements of the Hindu tradition, as well as Western theoretical framing. And I also engage issues of space, issues of what is rites and rituals, material religion, ethnography, and sort of individual interviews and all of that. So I also engage all of those kinds of tools of the trade in each of the chapters. Each of the chapters highlights one of those.
Fascinating. Speaking of ethnography, give us a little peek behind the curtain insofar as your process. What was the research process like? What was the, you know, how did you collect your data?
Sure. Well, I mean, I started going there in 2007. The book was supposed to come out in 2019. It was on track, except the temple burned down in 2018. And I actually had to completely rewrite parts of the book after that, because I knew I needed to incorporate that into the larger narrative of the book. So when I first started going, I was just attending functions. I think the first couple of years, I would go about 8 times a year until people got used to me. And I would talk to people, and I was there. I became close to one of the devotees. I call her Asha in the book. And so she housed me, she put me up, she introduced me to people. And of course, absolutely instrumental was the spiritual director of the temple. His name is G. Krishnakumar. And without him, this book could not have been written, because he allowed me behind the scenes in all kinds of ways. He made sure if something important was happening, that he called me and said, you have to come for this weekend, or you have to come for this week. And I had a place to stay. And Asha very generously put me up. She fed me. She took very good care of me, as did so many other members of the temple community. So after a while, I mean, over the course of almost 15 years of showing up constantly, you become sort of a fixture. And people would just start coming up to me and saying, oh, Kumar said, I have to talk to you. I have to tell you about my experiences, right? And so word of mouth kind of traveled. By the end, I felt very integrated into the community. This is also a community, even though it is heavily South Indian in terms of the congregation, it doesn't draw any boundaries, right? God is beyond boundaries. She doesn't care if you come, if you're a meat eater, if you are menstruating. She doesn't care about any of that, right? So I never felt like I was treated differently because I wasn't Indian, except by some of the newcomers to the temple who hadn't seen me. Every time you show up, right, somebody hasn't seen you there. Somebody's just moved, or they heard about the temple from a friend and they're showing up. And for those people, they would say, oh, you're interested in the goddess traditions, are you? This is Karu Mariaman. They would, you know, try to explain. And, you know, then I would say, well, actually, I've been coming here for a long time. I would like to find out more about you and how you ended up coming to the temple. So I could use that to my advantage.
Fascinating. So what does the book overall argue? What would you consider the key takeaways or the gist of the book?
Why, that's a hard one to answer because it's operating on several different levels.
Indeed.
There are a couple of key details, or key takeaways, I should say, from the book. The first is, you know, this is a case study, and as others have said, case studies are important because they get to the agentive level, how individual agents recreate and reinvent things and traditions and use traditions. So I would say one of the takeaways is, until we get granular and really look at communities very closely, it's easy to see patterns, you know, kind of gross patterns, pilgrimage patterns, ritual patterns, and so on. But when you get granular, that's when the challenges to those patterns arise. And I hope that the book challenges some of the uncritical use of some of those overarching terms, and in particular, the term diaspora. And I do argue, of course, there's disagreement about what the term diaspora means, but we tend to use the term very broadly and very inaccurately to describe all Hindu communities in the United States. And I argue this is not a diaspora temple. The claim is that the goddess has been present in Pontiac, Michigan forever, right? So she belongs here. She is just as American as she is Hindu. At least that is the theological claim of the temple. And so I think looking closely at individual communities, this is the big lesson, the big lesson, I think, of the book, gives you the opportunity to learn things and to challenge larger notions in ways that you don't get unless you do a deep dive into the particularity of individual communities and individual institutions. In terms of the goddess, the book really looks at the way in which this community is able to imaginatively imagine, it looks at the way in which there's a theologically imaginative recreating of the goddess, or reinstitutionalizing of the goddess in a way that the location in the United States makes possible, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense to me, and I imagine it would to our listeners as well. Was there anything that surprised you about this process, or about your conversations, or that was impressed upon you that perhaps you didn't anticipate at the outset?
Oh yeah, lots of things. In terms of, well, first of all, I was surprised at how much I came to feel part of the community, first of all. And I think that's a result of just having spent so much time there over the course of more than a decade. Although I didn't go during COVID, and I do talk about that also in the book. When I first encountered the temple, the very first time I ever talked to Kumar, and the first time he was the spiritual director, and the first time that I spent an overnight in Pontiac at Asha's house, I was invited to come and talk to him and, you know, just experience the temple. I immediately came up with an outline that became the basic outline of the book that changed actually very little over the course of 15 years. But the outline at the time was not the way, and was not informed in any way by the decolonial framing that he eventually brought to the book. So that surprised me at how much uncovering of interesting detail and interesting kind of side stories that opened themselves to me during the course of my research. That surprised me. And also just how much I grew to love the place and the people. And how incredibly generous the community was with me, and open and telling me everything I wanted to know, even if they then said, you can't publish this, but I'll tell you, just turn off your tape recorder. So the amount of trust that people put in me surprised me as well.
What's new from Apple? There's the new iPhone 16 Pro built for Apple Intelligence. And it comes with the all-new camera control, giving you an easier way to quickly access your camera tools. The new Apple Watch Series 10 has our biggest display and our thinnest design ever. And this? It's the sound of active noise cancellation, now available on one of two new AirPods 4 models. So quiet. Check out all of the new products and new features at Apple.com. You can even buy yourself something new. See Apple.com for product availability updates. Apple Intelligence coming this fall.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
It's fantastic. It's just, it's fascinating and heartening to learn that there, behind the research, above and beyond the research, there's a real connection and a real community and a real sort of kinship there, or sort of, you know, it sounds as if you really connected with that space and the people and the practices.
Well, it wasn't just me. I mean, the whole mission of the temple is to cross boundaries, right? We're not in India. This temple's not in India. So I know today many, many people are very invested in thinking about and talking about the influence of Hindu nationalism, right, on Hindu traditions in India. And that's a real thing. When you go to the temple in Pontiac, you find Muslims there, you find African Americans there. In fact, some of the people I met during big functions were Muslim friends of Kumar, who actually came over from India, because he goes back and forth all the time. The spiritual director of the temple, he goes back and forth all the time. And so he's in a very understated way, the temple is working to cross those boundaries, and to not fall into the traps of other kinds of institutions. So that was also heartening to me, seeing some of that at work at the temple. That doesn't mean they always succeed, or that they always see things the way I see things necessarily, in terms of how much religion should be involved, for example, politics and that kind of stuff. But they're very, very conscious about being as welcoming and open as possible, and also learning from other traditions. So you'll see, again, in the book, I put some of this, but there's talk about the Shekinah. There's talk that the Shakti Garba, which is buried, it's this box that's buried at the foot of the Rajagopura in front of the temple, is called the Ark of the Covenant, right? So the attempt to kind of bring in other traditions. Now, some might say that's appropriation. Some might say, you know, that's obnoxious. That was not the intent in any way of the people involved in those kinds of crossing of boundaries, not the intent at all. It was really about bridging gaps between and among peoples.
Fascinating. Yeah, I'd love to hear a little more about your views on diaspora or definitions or problematization. You know, I think there are many in the listenership who would benefit from hearing more about your perspective on that term and how it's used or how it ought to be used.
Sure. Well, it's not just me. I would love to claim that I was the first person to have thought of this. but of course, that isn't the case. There have actually been several scholars who've looked at the kind of sloppy way we use the term diaspora. Diaspora actually starts as a way of scattering, right? Scattering of peoples. And it starts as a way of describing from 2000 years ago, the scattering of Israelites outside of the what we now call Israel / Palestine, and understanding all of the weightedness of those terms, okay? But that's how the term was originally used, so the scattering of people. And my argument is this isn't a scattering, this is a gathering in, right? And all the language of the temple is about gathering in Shakti, gathering in the goddess's power and allowing it to unleash itself in beneficial ways to the whole Western hemisphere. So scattering doesn't catch it at all. Diaspora is kind of a scattering, also doesn't capture the way in which people who are not of Indian heritage are very deliberately and systematically brought into important decision-making in the temple. So for all of those reasons, diaspora, I started thinking about the term diaspora. And then when I started researching it, I discovered I'm not the only one. And so in the postscript of the book, I actually do a bit of a deeper dive into the term and the limitations of the term and some of the questioning around the term. And so when I conclude, I refer to the Parashakti temple not as a diaspora temple, but as a translocal, iterative, creative borrowing from Tulsi Srinivas, third space, Homi Bhabha register, that bears the traces of both American and Hindu religious and cultural worlds, but gives rise to something new. So that's obviously a mouthful compared to the simple term diaspora, but the word diaspora just doesn't convey properly what's going on there.
Fascinating. What would you say was, you know, if it's difficult to pick among one's children, but what would you say might be your favorite sort of chapter, concept, aspect, outcome of this research you enjoy the most?
Wow, that is a hard question. The chapters on material religion and the chapters on rites, okay, or ritual, I think for me were the most interesting and engaging to write. I think just because what I saw going on in the way I allowed me to push back on certain kinds of assumptions about both how material religion, how objects matter on what they do, and also in terms of rites and what they, Hindu rites and what they are. For example, pilgrimage. So in the chapter on Hindu ritual, which I think is chapter 4.
I believe so.
Yeah, I think it's chapter 4. Sorry, I actually turned it in a year ago. So, you know, it takes a long time for these things to wend their ways through the production schedule.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, but I've already started on to other things. So I have to go back and try to remember what I did. But yes, the chapter on rites. So for example, Kumar does this practice as a spiritual director of what he calls Pratinidhi pilgrimage. And I asked a bunch of people about it and they said, yeah, we've heard of it. And I looked it up. It's not very well known. And I've actually encountered people in India myself who do it. They go on pilgrimage for the benefit of another person, right? If you have an elderly parent or a grandparent who can't do the pilgrimage, you go in their stead. Well, Kumar, when he does Pratinidhi pilgrimage, he doesn't do it for himself. He does it because the goddess commands him to go to certain places, he says, in order to gather the Shakti and bring it back, to Michigan for the benefit of the community. And he doesn't just go to places in India. And so he's talked about, and I didn't include them all, but he's been to places in Malaysia. He went to Pompeii because he said terrible things happen at Pompeii and there's a lot of pain. And you have to have a little bit of Asuric energy at the temple, because if you have only divine energy, then people can't evolve. They have nothing to learn how to overcome. So he went and did Pratinidhi pilgrimage to Pompeii to gather up the negative energy there and bring it back to the temple in order to help devotees at the temple further on their spiritual journey. So it was things like that that I had not encountered in my fieldwork in India among Hindu women or my textual research on Hindu goddess traditions. This was stuff that taught me things that I had not known before, that I hadn't seen before in the material that I had studied elsewhere.
Yeah, I really like that insight about the Asuric element being useful for personal spiritual evolution. It reminds me of, to my mind, one of the most profound mythologizations of that process is the churning of the ocean between the demons and the gods. And how do we get the amrit? How do we get the poison? How do we get the riches without the demons and the asuras and the devas working Correct. In tandem in opposite directions, but nevertheless they're cooperating and they're collaborating on some level. So it really is fascinating that I was doing a lecture the other day, and I found myself saying something along the lines of, shadow is the greatest of gurus if you allow it to be, right? It teaches you what you need to know. Absolutely. So I really love that insight on behalf of this head priest. That, we need a little bit of the Asuric, otherwise what are we going to do? Is just sit in Sparga and hang out all day? Like
Exactly. So he's like, you need that energy at the temple, right? So this was a way of viewing the purpose of pilgrimage that I hadn't encountered before in any of my other studies, putting here on the hat of a Western scholar, learning how to think differently about what makes pilgrimage, right? And so that was really kind of fun to think about and talk about. And I have to say, what's really interesting about this temple, ritually you walk in, you think you're just in another, to use the term as it's often used, diaspora Hindu temple, right? Theologically, not at all, because the temple's not in any particular lineage. It's very much influenced by
innovative.
It's very innovative theologically. It's just totally out there. And there's a series of ongoing revelations, right? So the goddess talks to Kumar and others, I know your audience can't see, but I hope you see my scare quotes, right? She doesn't really talk. And he actually describes this, and I have it in the book, but she communicates with him and others about what she wants. And they then execute her desires, and the desires change, right? So the fire that happened in 2018, why did it happen? Well, after it happened, the goddess said, see, I planned this all along because something really bad is coming down the pike and this temple wasn't powerful enough. So it's going to need to be rebuilt, right? So theologically, it is constantly innovating. Even though ritually you walk in, you think, it's just another, right? Another South Indian temple, very traditional. Also the murtis that are there. That was one of the things that caught my attention when I first went to the temple. It's like, what kind of temple is this, right? So the goddess is there, sure. But there were all kinds of other, there was Medicinha, there was Shiva, there was Ganesha, there were a couple of South Indian village goddesses, and new ones are always being brought. And that's because the goddess, according to the temple theology, is constantly needing new energies to be given form at the temple to counter whatever's coming down the pike, because it is a temple of protection according to temple discourse. So that kind of material innovation also, I thought I learned also, challenged my own Western ideas about how murtis function and how temples function. This one totally not related in any way to any one particular lineage.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating innovation. So what comes to mind is there's a temple about an hour north of, I live in the holy city of Toronto. There's a temple about an hour north or so in Richmond Hill. It's in the outskirts of Toronto, the greater Toronto area. And it's been around for a while. I think it's been around since the late 70s, at latest early 80s. And it's a South Indian temple. And so much of what you describe is comparable in terms of the rituals, in terms of the priest's connections to the devatas and you know, but one piece that's utterly fascinating for a variety of reasons to my mind is the positioning of this priest, the priest that you're mentioning, who is on the one hand, classically, traditionally trained and propagating certain sort of parampara of rituals, and also at the same time, he seems to have the license, if not blessing, to innovate. And so whereby is that, you know, whereby does that authority arise? Or other questions that sort of arise are, in his mind, is he innovating according to his peers or more traditionalists? Is he actually going too far? You know, so it's fascinating. Where is he in terms of, you know, one man's innovator is another man's renegade, right? Like, you know.
Correct. Yes. So first of all, I need to clarify, he's not a priest. He's a gastroenterologist. he was not trained at all in priestcraft.
So who performs the traditional rituals in the temple then?
They have priests who they bring in they cycle through.
Yes.
There are always three or four. Sometimes there are four. And then when they're big functions, for example, the Kumbhabhishek and the rededication of the temple in 2 years ago in 2022, there were nine priests and they were brought in, some from India and some from other parts of the United States. But he's a spiritual director. He does not like to be called guru. He says he describes himself as a mailman. He just delivers the mail. The goddess sends him the mail. And he said, the difference is I get the privilege of opening the mail and reading it first, right? So he says, she tells me what I'm supposed to tell you. And so he's very much a charismatic leader in that way. He is not a priest. He is not trained in any way in priestcraft. I have met at the temple many people who nevertheless consider him their guru, and who will tell me in private that they think he's a siddha or he's a guru, right? So he's a very enlightened soul. I've also met people who said, what is this nonsense, right? I want a more traditional temple. Over the course of 15 years, I've talked to a whole lot of people and I've encountered both kinds of attitudes toward him, but it's not just him. And so I describe in chapter two, he's a gastroenterologist. Was until very recently, he recently retired. He's 80 years old now. He was a practicing gastroenterologist with an appointment at a hospital. And he describes, actually, he didn't describe this. It was a Caucasian woman who is deeply involved with the temple, that she got on the elevator one day with him and said, you've been coming to my dreams and giving me spiritual instruction. And there's also this goddess who's been appearing to me. And they compared notes and they say it was the same goddess coming to both of them simultaneously. Again, this is the crossing boundaries part. She's Caucasian, Euro-American woman. And so his authority is one of charisma, you know, kind of invoking that old Weberian, right? The authority of charisma versus the authority of office. He has charismatic authority. And the temple functions in his leadership because, I think, of his refusal to take on the moniker guru and to take on that moniker of I'm special. The way in which he plays his role there is I'm just delivering the messages. Okay. This is the God. And he even says the goddess built this temple. I didn't build this temple. I didn't build this community. She did. I'm simply the instrument that she's using to do it. Now, some of the theological teachings do depart from anything that you would find, you know, in any particular school. And so for some people, they interpret that, some devotees interpret that as the goddess really is communicating through Kumar. And other people say this is nuts and they leave. So, and there's the temple discourse about that is you have to be ready. And if you're not ready, you know, it's all here. He uses the language of consumption, right? The goddess is laying this beautiful spread in front of you. If you want to eat, eat. If you don't, if you don't leave, come back when you're hungry. Okay. So he uses that imagery of consumption, that the goddess is inviting you to consume, but you have to consume. And if you don't, that's up to you.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
This episode is brought to you by Starz. Lisa Tadeo's best-selling book is about to become your favorite new show. Based on a true story, the new Starz original series, Three Women, stars Shailene Woodley as Gia, a grieving and struggling writer who embarks on a cross-country road trip where she meets three women determined to radically change their lives. This one is not to be missed. Watch the season premiere of Three Women now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Fascinating, utterly fascinating. Is this work that you hope to continue in some way? What's next for you?
Good question. No, I'm done. Well, I have one more article based on a piece of one short article coming out in a book collection that is also, it's based on what's in the book, just about what happens when a goddess destroys her own temple, right? So it's about the fire and why the goddess allegedly, according to temple discourse, visited the fire upon the temple in 2018. I'm working in a slightly new direction, looking at Hindu popular literature and fantasy. And I'm not quite sure yet what I'm going to do with that. I do have one article that should be out next year in 2025 on Amish Tripathi's Ramchandra series and the rewriting of Sita in that series. But as for this particular temple, I believe I've said pretty much all I need to say about, or that I want to say at this point about that particular temple.
Fascinating. We'll certainly have to circle back when this next project of yours is out, and we'll continue the conversation. Was there anything else about the book or the project?
Let's hope it's not another 15 years.
You never know.
You never know.
Was there anything else about this project or this book that you hope to touch on?
Sure. Yes. I wrote it to be accessible. So, and some people, I know from experience, some people will not like that I have eliminated diacritical marks. But I do that because it is so off-putting to many undergrads and even some graduate students, if they're not in Hindu studies.
And the majority of lay readers.
And the majority of lay readers to open the book and see all these diacritical marks, they don't know what they mean and they get intimidated. So I have done my best to make it as accessible as possible, explaining concepts that may well be familiar to anybody, any of us. You know, we know what tantra is, we know what mantra is and what it does, we know what a yantra is, but if you're not inside that discourse, you don't. So I've written the book to be as accessible as possible while still being a scholarly monograph. And so for those of you interested in perhaps assigning it as an undergraduate text or a graduate student text, it is written with those audiences in mind. One of the reviewers already told me that she's going to assign it to her, so parts of it to her undergraduates and the whole book to her graduate students. So I hope people learn from it and benefit from it and learn something about the creativity of this particular community and by extension, probably other religious communities in North America as well.
Fascinating. And to my mind, I mean, I share your penchant, it might be a little biased, but really the entire enterprise of New Books Network, which is the largest conglomeration of podcasts on the planet, there are 100 subject-specific channels. The entire enterprise has to do with where sound scholarship meets accessibility. That's why I do this as a labor of love, because it's so important and crucial. And I think we're understanding more and more why that is because of the transformation afoot at the Academy. It's crucial that we let the public in that are interested and we not sort of have a gated community and that we don't, you know, being profound and smart doesn't mean speaking in opaque ways.
Correct. I mean, we have a specialized vocabulary, right? But we can explain ourselves along the way.
Exactly.
And that's a way of inviting people in. We can say, look, and you know, this is what we probably already do in our undergrad classes. If we're going to use the term yantra, briefly explain it and then use it, right? And trust in the intelligence of your readers to understand, to go back and check. So I did try to make this as useful a text as possible to those interested in goddess traditions, in sociology of religion in America, in anthropology of religion, in Hindu studies, in all kinds of fields, even if they have a passing interest and are not specialists in the area.
Excellent. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Oh, you're welcome, Raj. Thank you for having me.
For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Tracy Pinchman on a brand new OUP publication called Goddess Beyond Boundaries, Worshipping the Eternal Mother at a North American Hindu Temple. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the nature of the goddess. Take care.